Ladies and gentlemen, this play, as I mentioned previously, seems to have been written when when Shakespeare was about 38, in 1602. And many superlatives may be said to apply to this play. It is the first of his truly great plays, the most complex, perhaps, of all his plays, the most elliptical, the most discussed, and by far the longest. It's nearly twice the length, for example, of The Winter's Tale, and it is far too long for the modern theatre, which means that much of it has to be cut, and it's very difficult. So important are most of the scenes, it's extremely difficult when that point comes. What scenes can we cut? But as regards its being the most elliptical, this is partly because Shakespeare seems to rely on our imaginations more than some of us deserve. There are ellipses, that is certain, but everything of basic importance to the drama is, as always in Shakespeare, is clear. Let us just consider the play from the beginning, or rather from before the beginning. And this helps to explain certain things which are not explained expressly in the play. Hamlet is a young man who has been living, one could say, in something of a fool's paradise. Everything has seemed to conspire for his happiness. Deeply loving parents whom he loves deeply. We must note the somewhat bitter remark of Claudius also. The queen, his mother, lives almost by his looks. And twice Claudius remarks how much Hamlet is loved by the people of Denmark. Besides all this, he's in love with Ophelia, who returns his love and whom he hopes to marry. Everything seems perfect. And he's been brought up as heir to the throne and seems to fulfill that function exceedingly well. He is, to quote Ophelia, the courtier's, soldier's, scholar's, eye, tongue, sword, the expectancy and rose of this fair state, the glass of fashion and the mold of form, the observed of all observers. And suddenly it is all gone. His father is dead. His profligate uncle has taken the throne and married his mother. And his shock at his, as what has happened with his mother and her agreeing to this marriage has obviously affected, as we shall see, his whole attitude towards women, and possibly including Ophelia. But the play shows us, however, that the losses he has suffered were really a blessing in disguise. And the same applies even to his mother. For neither Hamlet nor his mother, during those happy years, were more than a part of their full nature. The precept, know thyself, which we concentrated on very much in the last lecture, was by no means fulfilled. The fall of Gertrude may be likened to the fall of Angelo in Measure for Measure to a certain extent. A hitherto unknown weakness in the soul suddenly manifests itself. and throws the soul off its balance. And what has happened, as we shall see, is a reenactment of the fall of man. That is what happened to Gertrude. Hamlet's unknown weaknesses are more subtle, and his overcoming of them is the main theme of the play. By the end, both he and his mother are, I think we can say, that Shakespeare intended us to see them as perfect. And though he makes the perfection of Gertrude less clear, in art, the victory over one fault may stand for the victory over all, because the artist cannot obviously take in all details. But we shall come back to this later. Shakespeare, like other true artists, does not force the deeper meanings of his plays upon us, but he does demand a certain openness on our part, a certain pliancy and flexibility. In other words, he trusts us not to say to him, as regards the simultaneous plurality of meanings at different levels, "You cannot have it both ways." Nor does he trust us in vain, for by the time anyone might be tempted to say anything, any such thing, we are totally under his spell. The fall of man is often to be seen in Shakespeare and in other plays through a deliberately transparent literal meaning. In Shakespeare, it is never perhaps more obvious than in Hamlet. The setting for the murder of King Hamlet, the garden with its fruit trees, and in the offing, the potentially guilty woman, and above all, the presence of the serpent, stands allegorically, without question, for the Garden of Eden, where Adam was made mortal by the poison of the forbidden fruit at the instigation of the serpent. It was given out at King Hamlet's death that a serpent had stung him in the garden, and he tells his son in the ghost scene, "The serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown." So King Hamlet may thus be identified allegorically with Adam and Claudius with Satan. And since we are altogether accustomed of thinking of Adam in two ways, that is, the perfect man made in the image of God, and the man who fell, we can easily accept Hamlet speaking of his father in exactly the same two ways, the more so since King Hamlet, being a soul in purgatory, is already saved and on his way to paradise. It is thus that the Catholic Church speaks of saints, of souls in purgatory, as animae sancti, holy souls. To return once more to this question of plurality of meanings, it can be said that at any rate by the end of the ghost scene, the audience are conscious to a man of the urgency of the need for Hamlet to kill Claudius. They have heard three different people say, one says something is rotten in the state of Denmark, and Hamlet says the time is out of joint, and the ghost himself has said, "Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest. Luxury means is the sin of lust. Luxuria in Latin was the name of the deadly sin of lust. So the word luxury stands for that. But for many of the audience, the sense of urgency will be increased by an extra dimension in virtue of the presence of a deeper meaning, even if they are not fully aware of it. For that meaning is there, and the fall of man has, as we have seen, been reenacted in the murder of King Hamlet. His words, "The serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown," make Claudius the exact equivalent of the dragon that has to be killed in so many other symbolic portrayals of the way of the mysteries. His wearing of the crown is a reference to the original sin, that is, the devil's having a hold over fallen man. In fact, every member of the audience is in the same situation as the Prince of Denmark, with an inner dragon that it is their duty to kill. And if few are conscious of this, perhaps less few are subconscious of it. But the higher significance of Eve does not enter into the question. On the contrary, at the beginning of the play, Gertrude may be said to personify fallen man's whole ancestral line going back to Eve, the first faller. And for this purpose, Shakespeare gives her an aura of mysterious and unfathomable guilt, which might seem to go far beyond her actual deserts. But nonetheless, although there cannot be the slightest doubt that according to the literal meaning of the play, Gertrude is altogether innocent of the murder of King Hamlet, and indeed altogether ignorant of it, the very fact that she was willing to marry a monster of a man immediately after having been widowed of his opposite comes somewhat near to ridding herself of the one in order to marry the other. And to rid oneself of a person can be equated allegorically with killing. Gertrude had in fact already rid herself of the memory of her first husband. And so it is that Shakespeare makes use of Hamlet's pretended madness. And very often, as you know, Shakespeare puts wisdom into madmen, into mad speech of madmen. It doesn't matter whether the madness is real or whether it's pretended, or whether it's the madness, the sort of madness that a king's fool has. But we find that in Shakespeare again and again. And when Hamlet is pretending to be mad, he speaks nearly always words of wisdom in a mad way, disguised. But in his madness, his pretended madness, he several times accuses his mother of having killed her first husband. And this helps to bring Gertrude's responsibility into line with that of Eve. Not that Eve killed Adam, I'm not saying that, of course, but she did give him the apple, and she is guilty as the first fallen woman. And it can be, it is after all, the making mortal of man, the fall, and can be likened to a killing. But Hamlet is very insistent about this. We shall see later some examples. The question of incest, on the other hand, serves to add to Gertrude's guilt. And in the verbal arrows which Hamlet shoots at his mother in the earlier parts of the play, he makes continual reference to the incestuousness of her recent marriage, simply in order to add sharpness to the point of his shafts. But although the marriage showed a monstrous disregard of established principles, in itself, that particular mode of so-called incest is blamelessly in the nature of things. After all, the patriarch Jacob married first of all Leah and then her sister Rachel, and his best son was the offspring of that marriage, which would be described as incestuous in the, according to the morality of this play and according to Christian morality. It would seem that the established doctrine of it being incestuous to marry one's sister-in-law or brother-in-law is a kind of typically Roman deduction from the principle that man and wife are one flesh. But it's an unnecessary deduction, and of course it has been discarded now in English law, though many people still cling to it. But it's noticeable that when Hamlet is at last able to speak his mind freely to his mother, the whole question of incest goes. His whole blame is exclusively concentrated on the evil of exchanging something excellent for something immeasurably inferior. In echo of his father's words, "O Hamlet, what a falling off was here." The two portraits of his father and his uncle, which form the basis of his upbraiding of his mother, have nothing to do with incest. Now, Dover Wilson, one of the greatest Shakespearean critics of the beginning of this century, or in the first half of the century, was very right in insisting that Shakespeare lived in the world of Plato and St. Augustine. And it is therefore not surprising that Shakespeare's concept of human perfection should coincide with that of the whole ancient world. To regain what was lost at the fall, a man must become once more fully as man was created, a priest king. King because he was placed at the center of this earthly state to be its ruler. Priest because his centrality has also a vertical aspect, that of being the mediator between heaven and earth. In some of the plays, these two aspects are forced into the background by some particularly characteristic fault which has to be overcome. And as we have said, we can accept that in art, and especially in the concentrated brevity of drama, the victory over one fault may stand for the victory over all. But in many plays, we are kept conscious of this definition of perfection, that of the priest-king and its feminine equivalent. And could it not be said that in Othello, Lear, and both protagonists of Antony and Cleopatra, the royal element is already much in evidence, and it is the priestly element which has to be regained? In the storm scene, when Lear is going mad, he's being fascinated by Edgar. My philosopher, as he calls him, shows that he is moving in the right direction. Othello, at the end, is conscious of having lacked wisdom, of being one that loved not wisely. But Hamlet, on the contrary, is by his very nature a priest, and he has some difficulty in accepting that he must be also a king. And that difficulty is, I repeat, the theme of the play. We may assume, I think, that Claudius staked much on what we have just been saying about Hamlet. If Laertes, for example, had been Hamlet, we can imagine that when the news came to Wittenberg of his father's death and Claudius' election as king, he would have marched back to Elsinore at the head of a daily increasing body of men. And if when Laertes from France did the same when the news came to him of Polonius's death, and if his followers shouted, as in fact they did, Laertes shall be king, how much more would they have shouted for their prince, Hamlet shall be king? But Claudius was safe on that score. We shall never know exactly how, to quote Hamlet's words in the last scene, he popped in between the election and my hopes. But there must have been quite a long period of plotting, of saying just the right word to the right person, of gaining the gratitude of all sorts of people by securing for them advantages which, as the king's brother, he could easily do. And he would also, of course, have his own particular friends of the same disreputable nature as himself. Birds of a feather flock together. And I think there can be no doubt that although Hamlet is speaking of the world as a whole, when he uttered the following words, he's referring in particular to the horrible difference between the court of his father and the court of Claudius. That is, to the brilliantly dressed time servers and sycophants who have just left the stage to the flourish of trumpets. Fie on't, O fie! 'Tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. He may well have been thinking especially of the passage in Claudius's first speech, where, in speaking of his marriage to Gertrude, he makes those present share his responsibility by saying that he has consulted them at every stage of the affair. We may be sure that he has not consulted anyone of whom there was the slightest possibility of his saying no. But we can imagine, as he says these words, nor have we therein barred your better wisdoms, which have freely gone with this affair along, for all our thanks. And we can imagine, as he says this, that he smiles round the room of state where this scene takes place. And we can imagine also the many smiles, the many answering smiles all round, and much nodding of heads. One can imagine the sort of thing that would be said to him, Your Majesty, what disadvantages there might be in this marriage is far outweighed by its advantages, that sort of thing. This scene can be visually most effective, because I can remember performances from more than 50 years ago that still impressed themselves on my memory. And of course they had, in those days, nearly always very beautiful music to Shakespeare's plays, and the dresses were good. And you see this this courtroom full of splendidly dressed people. And then perhaps at the back there's a staircase, and you see Hamlet dressed entirely in black coming down the staircase. And everybody gets up out of respect for him. And then another flourish of trumpets, and the king and queen, also brilliantly dressed, come festively down the stairs. And Hamlet sits on a small throne below theirs, as a rule, and they sit on a big throne above. And his presence in black, from head to foot, dominates the whole scene, although to begin with it's a long time before he speaks at all. He's there, and you have this first speech, hypocritical speech of Claudius, horribly hypocritical. Our sometimes sister, now our queen, have we, as 'twere with a defeated joy, with one auspicious and one dropping eye, with mirth in funeral and with dirge in marriage, in equal scale weighing delight and dole, taken to wife. And that serves as a foil for Hamlet's first speech, when he does finally speech. And Hamlet is the very personification of sincerity, just as Claudius is the opposite. Now, it is typical of Hamlet that he wants to go back to Wittenberg. But Claudius says in this scene that it is most retrograde to our desire, and that he must stay and keep him company in Elsinore. He obviously wants to keep him under observation. But then comes the task imposed on Hamlet by his father, which makes it in any case imperative that he shall stay in Denmark. The ghost says to him, "If thou didst ever thy dear father love, revenge his foul and most unnatural murder." Hamlet's reply is exceedingly ironical. Shakespeare is a master of irony, as we know, and this play has many, many examples. Hamlet says, "Haste me to know it, that I, with wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love, may sweep to my revenge." But Hamlet knows his own general tendencies. He has already mentioned in an earlier scene Hercules as being poles apart from himself, presumably because Hercules, with his labors, is a man of action. But if Hamlet is slow to act, he's very quick to think. And by the end of the scene, by the end of the ghost scene, he has not only made those with him swear to keep the appearance of the ghost a secret, but also made them swear that if they ever see him behaving like a madman, they will not offer any sign of knowing the explanation. For he has already decided, even in that short space, that it will probably be necessary for him to put on a show of madness. As to sweeping to his revenge, as he said in his answer to his father's first remark, that idea has been replaced by the thought that brings the scene to a close. The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that I was ever born to set it right. But why the madness? It is never explained to us, but the answer may be deduced perhaps from his reply to his mother's question in the first scene in the courtroom, why in the room at court, why his sorrow at his father's death seems to be so great since all must die. Seems, madam, nay, it is, I know not seems. He is, as I said, the personification of sincerity. He is also ultra sensitive. He knows he would not be able to hide his feelings from Claudius. And if he continues to behave normally, he could not hide his feelings, but the mask of madness would allay whatever suspicions Claudius might have. Hamlet is a supreme psychologist, and he knows that people tend to judge others by themselves, and that Claudius, in Hamlet's place, would be altogether preoccupied with plotting to kill the man who had taken the throne that he had always expected to have. But madmen, at least of the kind that Hamlet will pretend to be, are not politically ambitious. Also, madmen are usually humoured by those who are with them, and that would give him more liberty, and perhaps more opportunity of doing what he has to do. Another reason, though no doubt a secondary one, is that it would relieve the tension for himself. He had already said at the end of his first scene, "But break my heart, for I must hold my peace." But he will now be able to talk. And he is able to say, in fact, as we shall see, many pertinent things. Let's come now to another question, not directly answered in the text. What is the meaning of Hamlet's visit to Ophelia in her room after his meeting with the ghost? In a certain sense, Ophelia is now the nearest person to Hamlet in the world. What a wonderful relief it would be to unload part of the burden of his secret onto her. In fact, to take her completely into his confidence. But, as I said, his mother's unpredictable behaviour has probably shattered his confidence in women as a whole. And when he says in the first scene, summing up the case against Gertrude, "Frailty, thy name is woman." The generality of this statement not only serves to confirm the allegorical equation of Gertrude with Eve, but it also may be taken as regards the literal meaning of the play, to indicate that Ophelia is in his mind as well as his mother, if only in the form of a question, would Ophelia be capable of such weakness? When he comes and gazes into her face, is he not trying to find with his eyes the answer to that question? Or more particularly, the question, if I tell her everything, as a secret. Would she be capable of not telling her father? And Hamlet will, of course, have been revolted by Polonius's crawling subservience to Claudius. If this is the explanation of the visit, then the answer his eyes gave him to the question was no. All we have for certain is Ophelia's description. He took me by the wrist and held me hard. Then goes he to the length of all his arm, and with his other hand thus o'er his brow, he falls to such perusal of my face as he would draw it. Long stayed he so. At last, a little shaking of mine arm, and thrice his head thus waving up and down, he raised a sigh so piteous and profound that it did seem to shatter all his bulk and end his being. There is in any case not the slightest doubt of his love for Ophelia, but this was no time for marriages, and the priest like Hamlet was virtually something of an ascetic in any case. Everything must be sacrificed to the one thing necessary. It is not easy to kill a king, especially when that king is himself a regicide and will be all the more on his guard. It is still less easy to kill a king and escape with one's own life, and Hamlet is no optimist. The task laid upon him by his father was something of a sentence of death, and as regards the deepest meaning of the play, it must be remembered that the path of the mysteries is often spoken of as a death, a dying into life. But as regards the literal meaning, the following question arises inevitably in his mind. What will become of Ophelia after I am gone? The obvious answer seems to him that she should enter a convent. Otherwise, she will be married off to some worthless person at the court. He tells her of his thought in the famous nunnery scene, but in the language of madness. And in that scene, he receives, perhaps mistakenly, further confirmation that his decision not to confide in Ophelia was the right one. His famous speech in that scene ends, "What should such fellows as I do, crawling between heaven and earth? We are arrant knaves all. Believe none of us. Go thy ways to a nunnery." This preoccupation with sin, that scene is full of that, is of course typical of Shakespeare's representation of the aspect of hell in the lesser mysteries, the descent into hell, the getting to know one's own faults. You find it in all the plays. There is often a list of sins given out in Macbeth by Malcolm in England, by Edgar in King Lear. In his madness, he recounts a whole list of crimes and so on. It is all part of the setting of the descent into hell. But at the end of that speech, when he has said, "Go thy ways to a nunnery," editors have suggested that at that moment he sees the arras move, as if someone was behind it. You remember that the king and Polonius are behind the arras, listening to the whole conversation. It has been arranged. Ophelia knows this. But at any rate, whether he suspects or actually sees the curtain move, having said, "Go thy ways to a nunnery," He suddenly says, "Where's your father?" And it is scarcely conceivable that Ophelia, faced with this sudden cruel dilemma, could not have shown him on her face and in her voice that she is lying when she answers, "At home, my lord." And Hamlet must have felt at that moment that I am absolutely alone. There is no one I can confide in. He does decide to confide, and quite rightly, and with great relief to himself, in Horatio, who is a real, he sees is a real friend and a man to be totally trusted. And that is Hamlet's great relief throughout the play. And later he is able to trust his mother, but not for a long time. In the famous soliloquy that precedes this nunnery scene, Hamlet seems to be still toying with the question raised in a previous scene as to whether he should perhaps give up the idea of killing Claudius. It is well known in the mysticism of all traditions that when the initial ardour has worn off, the novice may go a little backwards before he begins to advance effectively on the way. Hamlet knows very well in his heart that the ghost was indeed his father's spirit and not the devil. But in this previous scene, he says, "The ghost that I have seen, the spirit that I have seen, may be the devil." He knows well in his heart that he is not the devil, but his soul will snatch at any pretext to avoid the dreaded taking of action. And he gives his soul a respite, at any rate, until after the play. The play is the thing. He says, "I'll have evidence more relative than this, more conclusive than what the ghost has seen me, has told me. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king." And now in the "to be or not to be" speech, he voices the same alternative with the question as to whether it is nobler to bear one's evils patiently or to fight against them and end them. Not by overcoming them, but by dying in the attempt. But then it becomes clear to him that he is not yet ready for death, when he thinks of death. Though in his first scene in the play, he had said what can be paraphrased as, "If only God had not forbidden us to kill ourselves." It shows that at that time he didn't really understand himself. But then his intelligence, towards the end of the "to be or not to be" soliloquy, triumphs, and he objectively analyzes his own state of soul and explains the cause of what we must call his spiritual paralysis. The word conscience here means too much thinking. He says, "Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sickly o'er with the pale cast of thought." With the result that purposes of the highest importance are not carried out. It may be noted that in mysticism, resolution is always held to be one of the essential virtues. The Sufi poet of the Middle Ages terms the path of the mysteries as the path of resolution. And since resolution is of the heart, not of the head, its native hue is red, the colour of blood. But in Hamlet, as he realizes, that red is forever being buried beneath the pale vomit of too much thinking.
We must remember this description given by Hamlet The negative hue of resolution is sifted off with a pale cast form, because it is absolutely relevant to what happens throughout the play. The success of the play performed for the king and queen altogether restores his resolution for the moment. Hamlet has written this play for his mother almost as much as for his uncle.
We see a king and queen, and the king thinks he may not live much longer and suggests that the queen may take a second husband, but she interrupts vigorously. In second husband, let me be accursed. None wed the second but who killed the first. Then again, she assures him, a second time I kill my husband dead when second husband kisses me in bed. And yet a third time, she insists. Hamlet turns to his mother, Madam, how like you this play? She says, the lady doth protest too much, methinks. What is surprising, rather, is that they have a dumb show to start off with. And I suppose people didn't take much note of the dumb show, but Claudius doesn't, he sees the man sleeping in the garden, he sees the poisoner come and pour poison into his ears, but he doesn't, it's all done probably very quickly and with music, and he doesn't appear to notice it. But finally, when the play is acted and the people speak, and the murderer holds up poison and addresses the poison and says, and then he sees him pour the poison into the sleeping king's ear, just as he did himself to King Hamlet. That is too much for Claudius. And he calls for lights and all go out, leaving Hamlet and Horatio alone. Now, as you know, in the next scene, Claudius is quite overcome. We must remember, again here, as regards the different levels of meaning, that in sacred art, unlike divinely revealed texts, not every detail can be said to have an inner meaning. The sensitivity of Claudius to the play belongs to Claudius the man only, not to him as the devil, clearly, and so does his praying in the scene which follows. And in this scene, Hamlet is given a perfect opportunity to kill him, without danger to himself and without having had to make plans. But immediately, the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, and he cannot do it. The reasons given are nothing to the point. On the one hand, how can Hamlet possibly suppose that a cold-blooded murderer will go to heaven simply for going down on his knees? And on the other hand, the notion of revenge expressed here by Hamlet loses altogether sight of the ghost's words. Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest. The point is to remove Claudius from life and from the throne. But Hamlet's soul clings desperately to these false arguments. Once again, anything to avoid taking action. But according to the play's higher meaning, the great dragon cannot be killed at this moment because he is not fully enough, he has not fully enough emerged from his lair, one might say, to be vulnerable. And other lesser dragons have to be killed first. Then comes the central scene of the play. Almost from the beginning, Shakespeare has contrived to make the audience long to see Hamlet alone with his mother. And even now they are not really to be alone, because the Queen has consented to have Polonius eavesdropping behind the arras. His presence there, and he is the personification of hypocrisy, coincides with Gertrude's decision to brazen things out. It's a curious situation, really, in a sense, because Hamlet is blamed very much for the play, for having presented the play. But it's really the king who should be explaining why he was so upset by it. I mean, one doesn't know, one wonders, which we'll never know. There's no scene telling us what the king said in explanation to the people why he was so upset, or what he said above all to Gertrude. She says to Hamlet, "Hamlet, thou hast thy father much offended." And he replies, "Mother, you have my father much offended." But we are not disappointed. This is one of the most wonderful and deeply satisfying scenes in all Shakespeare. There is an important point, however, which needs dwelling on, and though I mentioned it in a general lecture on Shakespeare that I gave for Temenos nearly 2 years ago, I think it was, I will mention it again for the sake of those who were not there. But unfortunately, most producers, including both Olivier and Zeffirelli in their recent films, failed to see this spellbinding dramatic moment which Shakespeare has offered to them, to the producers that is, and above all to their actors. The situation is also somewhat blurred by the stage directions inserted by editors, which are not to be found in either the quarto or the folio editions, which are those editions which the play depends on. And one of these stage directions that have been put in is at least strangely misplaced. I'll just remind you that the scene opens with an ironic few words between the Queen and Polonius, who tells her she must be very severe with her son, and she assures Polonius that she will be severe. Ironic, because Hamlet has already said, "I will speak daggers to her, but use none." And for this to be effective, this means that he, as we shall see, that he is going to confide in her more than he did in Ophelia, that he's going to take the risk of confiding in her that he is not really mad at all, but is only pretending to be, because otherwise he could not expect things he says in blame of his mother to be effective, as she could put it down as madness. In fact, he tries to stop her later on. He says, wonderfully expressed, "Lay not this flattering unction to thy soul, that not thy trespass, but my madness speaks." He enters, and they have this exchange of words. "Hamlet, thou hast thy father much offended. Mother, you have my father much offended. Go, go, you answer with an idle tongue. Come, come, you answer with a wicked tongue," says Hamlet. And then she says, "Have you forgot me?" Meaning, "Have you forgotten who I am?" And he answers, "No, by the rood, not so. You are the queen, your husband's brother's wife, and would it were not so, you are my mother." She makes a move to go out and says, she will fetch those who can speak to him. And he says, come, come and sit you down. You shall not budge. You go not till I set you up a glass where you may see the inmost part of you. She does not yet know that he is not mad, so she is not unnaturally frightened and cries out for help. Polonius echoes her cry, and Hamlet runs his sword through the arras and kills Polonius, hoping it is the king. Now, and he says, she says, what have you done? And he says, nay, I know not. Is it the king? And it's obvious at that moment, not as a sage direction, say that he lifts the arras, because he would obviously want to know. And when he lifts the arras, there is Polonius lying dead. And the queen says, oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this. Now, one of the reasons why the audience is longing for this scene is that they want to hear Hamlet telling his mother the truth about how his father died. It is not conceivable that Shakespeare should not have made Hamlet tell her. But he does so with such art that the play is usually acted with the apparently loose thread hanging, that Gertrude does not know the truth throughout the whole scene. Later in the scene, he calls Claudius a murderer, but that is not enough. But Gertrude, as well as Claudius, witnessed the play. She saw the murderer pour poison into the sleeping king's ear in the garden. And she saw the extraordinary effect that this had on Claudius. It may have raised a question in her soul, which she immediately brushed aside. It has become her habit not to think and to stifle all unwelcome thoughts. That's how she has been going on in these last weeks since she married Claudius. She's obviously just been stifling her thoughts. But when she says of the killing of Polonius, oh, what a rash and bloody deed is this. And when Hamlet replies, it should be very slowly and with great emphasis and intensity, a bloody deed. Almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother. She echoes the words, as kill a king. But her meaning is not, do you really think I killed your father? She knows perfectly well that Hamlet knows she is innocent. It doesn't occur to her the possibility. What she means is, was the king in fact killed? Was your father, my first husband, King Hamlet, was he in fact killed? Seldom can a dramatist have conveyed such close intimacy between two characters as Shakespeare does in this scene. And true intimacy is almost by definition telepathic and has power to replace the spoken thought by the unspoken thought. The looks, of course, must play their part, and there must be at this point a long and searching exchange of looks before Hamlet answers her question. Again, with great emphasis, I, lady, 'twas my word. As kill a king, I, lady, 'twas my word. And he has told her everything in this half line. And there is no need for more, because if the king was killed, there can be no doubt as to who was the murderer. But you see, that is passed over very quickly. I mean, when you see it on the stage and in both these films I mentioned, oh what a rash and bloody deed is this. A bloody deed, almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his mother, and marry with his brother. As kill a king, I laid it, was my word. Just as quickly as that. And the audience can't take it in at all. But it's wonderful subtlety on Shakespeare's part and wonderful dramatic economy. What wonderful opportunities it gives to the actors, the actor and the actress who play these parts. But as a result, the Queen's resistance is broken, and it is broken still further by the comparison of the two faces of that is the miniature of the father, of his father that Hamlet wears round his neck, and the miniature of Claudius, which the Queen wears. And finally she says, O Hamlet, speak no more. Thou turn'st mine eyes into my very soul, and there I see such black and grained spots as will not leave their tinct, such black and ingrained spots as will not cease to be black. Then the ghost enters at the moment that she has repented, and she does not see him. But on her behalf, the ghost delegates his spiritual power to his son and says, O step between her and her fighting soul. Speak to her, Hamlet. And Hamlet, the priest, tells her what she must do and not do. I think there cannot be the slightest doubt that she is altogether won over in this scene. You must remember, it is drama, and drama is always more concentrated. She keeps her word to Hamlet faithfully, and it may be doubted, in fact, whether she would have much difficulty in abstaining from Claudius's bed. Now she knows him to be a murderer in any case. But when he tells her that she must not divulge the fact that he is not mad and not mention anything that has happened that he has told her, she says, Be thou assured, if words be made of breath and breath of life, I have no life to breathe what thou hast said to me. And she reiterates her sense of guilt after Hamlet has gone to England. And in the next scene to this, when she first sees the king, she lies vigorously to Claudius about Hamlet. She says that Hamlet is mad as the winds and air, completely raving mad. But to go back to that bedroom scene, it's very moving how Shakespeare has it's to see the mother and son together with their normal relationship completely restored, and even the relaxed nature of their talk is moving when Hamlet simply says to her, I must to England, you know that. And she says, Alack, I had forgot, 'tis so concluded on. Then, on the way to England, Hamlet meets Fortinbras. And in Fortinbras he sees the model of a man who, we don't need to think or to tell ourselves that Fortinbras is perfect, though Shakespeare shows in him a man who has the particular perfection that or the particular virtues that Hamlet has to develop. That is what Hamlet sees in him, and he seems to take from Fortinbras all that has been lacking in him, which has been growing but still is not perfected. And at the end of the scene, when he says, "From this time forth my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth," that means he could say in his previous language, "My thoughts will be the colour of the native hue of resolution that is not sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought." And then there is the divine intervention which takes place, which anticipates, maybe said to anticipate the divine interventions in Shakespeare's later plays, because as there is in The Winter's Tale and in Cymbeline, because Hamlet is inspired to open the sealed letters on the boat, which contain contain Claudius's order to the King of England to put Hamlet to death immediately on arrival. And that restores, that gives him a perfect trust in providence. And when he comes back to England, Horatio sees him as a changed man. He is conscious that heaven has saved him to do the task that he has to be done. The time is still out of joint, but there is absolutely no longer any question of, "Oh, cursed spite that I was ever born to set it right." And we know that Claudius has not much longer to live. And Hamlet's attitude to death has changed. What he says is simply, "The readiness is all." What matters is to be ready for death when it comes. Now we know what Claudius and Laertes have plotted. The poisoned, unbaited rapier and the poisoned drink. And it is perhaps worth noting, so there's a slight interest, that in the first printed text of Hamlet, the quarto of 16.3, it is the king who originally has the idea of poisoning the rapier. It's not Laertes. Laertes agrees, and he says that he has just the right poison, but it's the king who has the original idea of it. And that does seem to coincide with what Laertes says at the end, when both he and Hamlet have been wounded by the poisoned rapier, and Laertes is almost dead. He tells Hamlet about the poison, and he says, the king's to blame. But of course, doesn't say that Laertes was not to blame, because he agreed to do it. But nonetheless, he is not a villain, Laertes. He had, Hamlet had killed his father, and Hamlet says that he recognizes, he understands Laertes' feelings by measuring them with his own feelings. And if Laertes had been a villain in Shakespeare's conception, Hamlet would never have said to Horatio, as Laertes enters at Ophelia's funeral, he says to Horatio, "That is Laertes, a very noble youth." But after Hamlet's apology to Laertes, before the duel, Laertes becomes more and more reluctant to go through with the plot. And when he himself is dying, he says, "The foul practice hath turned itself on me." And he is now completely on the side of Hamlet. And it is, in a sense, he who gives Hamlet the signal for accomplishing his great task. The king's to blame. In this play of the lesser mysteries, that is, of hell and purgatory, these two aspects are simultaneous and inextricably combined. The getting to know one's faults and shortcomings and the purification from them. The greater mysteries are only referred to at the end, summed up in Horatio's farewell to Hamlet. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. And that is, well, I think that must be the end, because I see the time has run out, but it does make an end.